Welcome to the View Magazine's Rebel Justice podcast. This week is the second part of our discussion between Simon Natus and Jeremy Dean KC. Simon is an award-winning solicitor specialising in criminal defence and protest law and human rights-related work. Jeremy Dean is one of the UK's most experienced and highly regarded criminal defence and appeals barristers. He served as joint head of chambers at 25 Bedford Row and has vast experience in defending serious, complex and high-profile cases. In part one, Jeremy talked about his rise from a working-class background to become a top criminal defence advocate, representing the interests of people less fortunate in life. Simon and Jeremy shared stories of successful cases and talked about how the legal system has evolved over the years, including the game-changing Jogi case. This week, they discussed the appeals process, including looking at where things need to change to allow a fairer and more just system where people can appeal their convictions and sentences.
Probably a good time to talk a bit about the appeals system. I think it might be right, I'm not sure whether you agree, Jeremy, to say that the appeals system is probably the area of our criminal justice system that has the most scrutiny, perhaps the most criticism, perhaps arouses the most concern amongst practitioners. I think it's fair to say, certainly amongst people who get involved in the criminal justice system, who, and you know, come out of the other end with a bad result, and are reliant on the appeal system to try and correct what they often feel is the wrong result. But once they come up against it, they find that it doesn't do the things that they necessarily hope it will. Obviously, you've had a lot of experience of the Court of Appeal, and for the first time in a very long time, we've actually got the Law Commission talking about quite fundamental change to the Court of Appeal, which I think is a really significant development. But I just wondered whether you could perhaps tell us what, in your view, are the major problems with the Court of Appeal? Big question.
I mean, what I say to you, Simon, first of all, is that I think the makeup of the criminal appeal judiciary is bizarre, because, you know, something that I find strange, and I've always found strange, is that you go to the Court of Appeal criminal division, and very often you're met with a constitution of judges, none of whom have any criminal experience at all. I know Professor David Ormerod gave a lecture on this about a year ago, and the question of whether the Court of Appeal Criminal Division should in fact be made up of criminal practitioners. So that's the first point I've made, that so often that feel of criminal justice just isn't there, and things are looked at far too academically rather than, you know, the reality of the situation. That's my first point. I think that the platform for success in the Court of Appeal needs radical change. You know, the limitations of grounds for appeal being essentially, you know, error of law by the judge, misdirection by the judge, and the admission of fresh evidence. The framework's just far too tight. And although the ultimate test is whether the conviction is unsafe, you know, you have to get over those specific obstacles. Did the judge make a significant error of law? Did the judge, you know, materially misdirect the jury? Is the fresh evidence admissible under what in itself is a complex and, you know, prosecution-weighted regime for the admission of fresh evidence? So, you know, the major change, it seems to me, should be that the ultimate test of whether the conviction is unsafe should be widened to allow the Court of Appeal to focus much more on the quality of the evidence that led to the conviction and also the fairness of the trial. At the moment, if it's blatantly obvious that the trial was unfair, unless you can get over the specific hurdles under the Criminal Appeals Act, which I've referred to, you won't win. So ultimately, I think scope for success in the Court of Appeal has to be significantly widened. And that's the major change that needs to come.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with that. I think one of my experiences as a solicitor is I quite often get people coming to me saying, I've been convicted quite often, it's of murder. These are all the things that went wrong in my trial.
Yeah.
And I'll go through a whole list of things. And quite often they are just that the evidence was weak. The jury should never have come to the conclusion that they did based on the evidence. The judge let in things which, to be honest, you know, we were talking previously about letting in previous convictions of knives and things like this. This comes up quite often. But they think that because the outcome was so unexpected, and it often is, particularly in joint enterprise murder cases, they think they therefore should have an opportunity to have a rehearing effectively in the Court of Appeal of some description. But of course, that's not the case. And it's, as you've explained, it is necessary to demonstrate that something actually went quite fundamentally wrong in the trial process, which is often a very hard thing to do. And even if you manage to do that, the court will quite often say, but the outcome wouldn't have changed the outcome anyway,
yeah. Yeah.
Which is obviously so unbelievably difficult. I mean, the Law Commission appear to recognise that it is all drawn too tight, as you say, and they've asked whether there are various things that should change. I mean, one of the concepts that they talk about is lurking doubt. So where, yeah, you might not be able to demonstrate that something went fundamentally wrong with the trial, the judge's ruling, the summing up, the admission of evidence. You may not have any fresh evidence. But nonetheless, when you stand back and you look at a conviction, it just feels that it's fundamentally wrong. And that is still supposedly part of our appeal system. It never really comes up. And I don't think, Jeremy, you can recall a case where you've had an appeal quashed for lurking doubt.
Not for as long as I can remember, no. Not. And I think lurking doubt, you know, it's a very, very old-fashioned expression now, but it's one that, you know, is as pertinent today as it ever was. I mean, if you or I went before the Court of Appeal in the modern era and said that the basis of this appeal against conviction is lurking doubt, you'd be laughed out of court, wouldn't you? But actually, lurking doubt, it should be really what it's all about.
Exactly.
What it should be all about.
Yeah, most people would think that that is exactly the situation in which you would stand the best chance of getting your appeal overturned. The Law Commission actually know that there is a case, the Crown against Pope, in which the court actually examined what lurking doubt meant.
Right.
The definition is, well, they said it required an inexorable conclusion reached through a reasoned analysis of the evidence or the trial process or both that the conviction was unsafe. Well, in practice, that just seems to me to be the same test in the Appeal Act. You've got to show that something went fundamentally wrong with the trial.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like lurking doubt to me.
It doesn't. No, so
I think you know that the problem is, as you've said, it's just so difficult to succeed on conviction in the Court of Appeal. It's incredibly difficult to succeed. They always seem to find a way of upholding the conviction. So we do have an appellate structure, but it has to be changed to make the prospect of success more realistic. Otherwise, sometimes you just feel, I mean, it's such hard work as well, that it's soul destroying, that it's pointless.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the other things they point out are quite interesting. So I think you mentioned earlier about fresh evidence and admitting fresh evidence, which is another really big part of appeals, particularly. Normally, these are going to be out-of-time appeals. You always have 28 days from conviction to lodge an appeal, but how are you going to find fresh evidence within 28 days? So these sometimes come months or years after the event. But I think, and maybe you've got some good examples of this, I don't know, that quite often you'll come up with some fresh evidence that you think is really good, like, and really important. And yet, when you get to the Court of Appeal, for some reason, they're not interested.
Yeah.
I mean, I can just think of one example at the top of my head, which is a case where a client was convicted of Section 18, but largely on the basis that there was some of the victim's blood were on his shoes. And I actually worked out that the forensic evidence trial, the blood splatter evidence, was actually completely wrong, completely misleading. The people who represented him had instructed an expert who I don't think had done a proper job. And I got an expert who really did do a proper job. And it was pretty clear that this guy who was serving an 8-year sentence should never have been convicted. But the Court of Appeal basically said, oh, you're just expert shopping. And they weren't interested. I don't know whether that's been your experience.
Yeah, I mean, it has been my experience. One of the sort of specific problems with the fresh evidence regime is that, you know, at the moment, you've got to get past a number of sub-hurdles. So you have to establish that the evidence is new in that it wasn't reasonably available at the trial, that it's credible, that it potentially would have had a significant impact on the jury's verdict. Those are very difficult things to establish. And if you come in as a new lawyer and you secure fresh evidence, you know, very often you're greeted with skepticism and you get a cold reception on the basis, well, you know, like, you're coming with this fresh evidence, but no one at the trial seemed to think that it was important. And, you know, when quite often that was an error or a lack of thoroughness. But that obviously brings us to another aspect, which is how difficult it is to base an appeal on the suggested incompetence of other people. And I don't like putting other people down, but there are cases, and I know you will have experienced these, Simon, which are linked to fresh evidence or not linked to fresh evidence, where we are instructed as new lawyers and we feel that things should have been done which weren't done. But then it's very, very difficult to argue those kind of points. And it's also very difficult to get fresh evidence in when the trial legal team didn't pursue those angles. So whichever way you approach an appeal against conviction, you are met with extremely difficult obstacles. and the prospects of establishing that conviction is unsafe are limited. But lawyers like you and I, who enjoy appellate work, who feel that the appellate structure is really, really important, you know, we pursue appeals because we believe that it's a route that needs to be maximized. And I strongly believe that. I think it's a vastly underused facility, the appellate route.
I actually agree. I mean, I think the point that you make is quite right. It's just the barriers to admitting fresh evidence need to be just a great deal lower. And really what we need, I think, is a Court of Appeal which is eager to accept fresh evidence, not overwhelmingly opposed to it, because they should be thinking, well, has anything gone wrong in this case? Well, we actually need to give this really serious thought because... Yeah. The idea that an innocent person may have been convicted is such an appalling one that we will, even if we ultimately, it turns out we have wasted our time because it turns out that there's nothing in it. Actually, we haven't wasted our time because what we've done is ensured that there is no possibility that an innocent person is serving a
job. Very briefly, take up a couple of aspects of that because they're really important. Firstly, I think what you've just said does drive us back to the question of the makeup of the criminal appellate judiciary, because I do think that if the criminal appellate judiciary was far more embedded with people like you and me who live and breathe criminal practice, that the prospect of the appellate judiciary, you know, looking at appeals favourably and admitting fresh evidence would be higher. Secondly, just to give one example of, you know, the problems that we face, I mean, there is, as you know, almost a blanket prohibition against basing an appeal on the suggested incompetence of trial legal teams. So what that means is that, as for example, in a murder appeal that I'm doing at the moment, where it cries out that the defendant was autistic and that a psychologist and or a psychiatrist should have been instructed, you know, it's clear that that should have happened, but it didn't happen. But to actually base an appeal on, you know, the suggested admission of psychological psychiatric evidence when the defence had the opportunity to pursue that at trial and didn't. I mean, we have to jump so many hurdles, don't we? And so many obstacles are put in our way. And you feel like saying in the end, for God's sake, it's so obvious that the jury should have heard expert evidence. Just let us call that evidence. But of course, it doesn't work like that. You end up with this long and winding road, which very often you hit a cul-de-sac. And that's just how it is. That's just how it is.
Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. I mean, what's also interesting, actually, when you read this issue paper the Law Commission has put out, is that they actually go, you know, they analyse things that I suppose we kind of forget in a way. But what they point out is the rationale, or one of the key rationales that the Court of Appeal uses to justify erecting these barriers to admitting fresh evidence, is their concern that defendants will use the first trial as a dry run for an appeal. As a defense lawyer, that is barking mad. I've never come across a case where I thought my client was using the trial as a dry run for an appeal. Never. They don't even know about how the appeal system works. Exactly. It wouldn't even occur to them.
I totally agree. If I could just bring in very quickly here, you know, the question of appeal against sentence. And one of the most shocking examples of my career of how it can be demonstrated that the appellate, you know, structure is just far too tight. Because on an appeal against sentence, the defence have to establish either that the sentence was wrong in principle, i.e. that it shouldn't have been a custodial sentence, for example, or that the sentence was manifestly excessive. So one of those two. I defended a guy about 18 months ago who had no previous convictions, who got 30 months for a drugs supply offence. He went into Wormer Scrubs with perfect sight. He came out of Wormer Scrubs blind in one eye, and the appeal came on just when he was about to be released. We were able to show conclusively that he developed some sort of eye problem early in his sentence, a catalogue of oversights and errors at Wormer Scrubs prison, which undoubtedly led to him going blind in one eye. And we based the appeal against sentence. He had about 4 or 5 months of his sentence to go. We wanted immediate... I didn't defend him at the trial. I was instructed on the appeal. But anyway, we wanted the sentence reduced. Do you know, their response to this was, the test on appeal against sentence is whether the sentence imposed was manifestly excessive. We are not prepared to look at events which develop post-sentence in judging the merits of the sentence. And therefore, the fact, if it be correct, that this person went blind in one eye while he was serving his sentence is irrelevant. So the strict application of manifestly excessive, no compassion guy, you know, is left blind in one eye for life, and he has no recourse to the failures that he experienced at Wormskrog prison because the test was applied so incredibly inflexibly. I mean, that's not justice, is it?
Absolutely, that's not justice. I mean, I don't think most people who are not actually, you know, involved in the criminal justice system or deal with it on a day-to-day basis would believe that it wasn't possible for a court of appeal to exercise a discretion in that situation. Yeah. And it is. The word you use is compassion. That's what it comes down to.
Not one day off his sentence.
No, that really is
shocking. I felt like saying to them, when the judgment came, and it was clear that they were going to go that way from the way they were dealing with my submission, I felt like saying, you know, are you serious? But obviously...
Yeah. I mean, the converse sometimes happens where you've got somebody who's, you know, may have grounds to argue the sentence is manifestly excessive, but also wants to rely on how well they've done in custody, how they've achieved quite a lot since they've been serving their sentence, and wants to rely on that sort of thing. That's pretty much equally difficult. Not really interested.
There's also unpredictability where you can be in court 8 and they'll say that post-sentence behaviour is irrelevant. And then you'll see people coming out of court 9 and you say, how do you get on? Well, they got a year off because you got a fantastic prison report.
Yeah, lack of consistency. So another big part of the appeal system, and an equally controversial one, I think it's fair to say, is the CCRC, Criminal Cases Review Commission. I'm not sure everybody listening will necessarily know exactly what that is, but perhaps you could tell us a bit about the background of the CCRC and how it came to be.
My understanding and recollection is that it came about following the Guildford 4 case and, you know, repeated appeals going to the Court of Appeal and being unsuccessful, and that time-honoured declaration by Lord Lane, the then, you know, historic Lord Chief Justice, that, you know, every time this appeal comes before me, I feel that, you know, effectively the prosecution position is stronger. So this new body was set up, the CCRC, the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which would allow people to go to the CCRC and potentially have their cases referred back to the Court of Appeal if it was considered by the CCRC that there's a real possibility that conviction might be overturned on conviction or sentence. So it's a body which a defender could go to post-appeal in the quest for the case to be referred back to the Court of Appeal and then have a subsequent appeal. Unfortunately, in my view, I don't know what you think, Simon, but I think on the whole, as has been demonstrated by the case of Andy Malkinson this year, but I felt it for some time, the CCRC hasn't really worked. I mean, firstly, the test of real possibility that conviction or sentence will be overturned, you know, is too high a threshold, and it really should be something along the lines of, you know, that the conviction might be unsafe or that the sentence might be considered manifestly excessive. But also it just takes far too long. It can take 2, 3, 4, 5 years for the CCRC to make their decision. And that's just too long. I mean, if you've been unjustly convicted or unjustly sentenced, you know, for you to serve an extra 5 years because the process is just too cumbersome is unjust. It's just layers of injustice. And I think the CCRC is cumbersome and too slow.
Yeah, well, I mean, the CCRC, I think when it was set up, and it was set up following the Guildford 4 case and the other high-profile miscarriage of justice cases that there were in the 1980s and that were overturned in the early 1990s. And it was felt that what was needed was an active body. It's not a reactive one.
Yeah.
One that would actively go out and investigate and have the resources and the tools to investigate miscarriages of justice to make sure that you didn't have a situation where someone would serve 16 years or longer for a crime that they didn't commit. You know, we couldn't allow that to happen again. That was the idea. And the idea, I think, behind the CCRC was that it would be funded to do this, properly funded. And actually, it's just had its funding stripped away over the years to the point at which, you know, I think the delays you talk about, which are absolutely true, can be put down largely just through lack of funding, lack of personnel. But also, I think it was envisaged that it would be really quite powerful body. And that's the other side to it. When the Criminal Cases Review Commission spoke and said, we think something's gone wrong, the Court of Appeal would listen.
Yeah.
I think that's what was envisaged.
Yeah.
But that's not been the case at all.
You're spot on. You're spot on.
It hasn't happened. And the real, I mean, that it's possible that was always going to be the case because the real possibility test that they cannot refer a case unless they think there's a real possibility the Court of Appeal will overturn the conviction. And when you get a Court of Appeal that is as resistant to overturning convictions as we've identified, then it makes that much more difficult.
Yeah, you're so right, because your point is that, you know, this powerful body was set up to send the message to the Court of Appeal on appropriate occasions. Look, there's a problem here and we need you to sort it. Whereas my experience, and I'm sure yours is the same, is that if you go to the Court of Appeal via the CCRC, there's a kind of scepticism along the lines of what have they managed to cobble together here? So
100%.
One concept I'd like to mention briefly, one aspect of the system that I've never liked is the innovation of the prosecution's right to appeal against sentence on the grounds that the sentence is unduly lenient. So for many years of my career, I don't remember exactly when unduly lenient sentences, the concept was introduced, but I really don't like the fact that for the last 20, 25 years, the prosecution have been allowed to appeal sentences, and that there are occasions when an offender gets a non-custodial sentence and then 6 months later is effectively sent to prison. And also where, let's say, an offender gets 5 years from the judge and the Court of Appeal double it or double it plus. I think that's cruel. And I really don't like that aspect of the system at all. I was in a death by dangerous recently. I had a guy who was of exemplary character, went out one night, he got drunk, he killed a woman and two dogs at some traffic lights. He was immediately contrite. He knew he was going to prison. It took 18 months for the case to come on, even though he was pleading guilty. He was amazing, you know, got his life together, said, I'll take whatever I was given. Very strong mitigation. He got 6.5 years. Prosecution appealed it. They increased it by 4 years. So he'd settled into his sentence. He was contrite. He was remorseful. 6 months into his sentence, it's effectively doubled. I mean, that's cruel, isn't it, in my view?
It is.
I think that's cruel.
It is cruel. And I think you can really justifiably ask what social purpose that actually serves. Why should that be the case, that the Court of Appeal should be able to increase people's sentences? I mean, quite often when they're already serving quite long sentences anyway.
Yeah.
I suppose that does raise another question. I think it's a very fundamental one, and I'm not sure we've got time to explore it necessarily in any great depth. But it does seem to me that prison sentences have got quite a lot longer over the years. And there just seems to be a belief that exists within the judiciary and perhaps beyond that prison sentences are somehow a panacea, and that by making them longer and longer, we can somehow deal with the social ills that give rise to criminal behaviour and the damage that it causes. But I mean, what I've never heard once is anyone adequately explaining why that should be so. I mean, is that your experience?
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, I find that 41 years later, I still find the whole idea of locking people up a challenging one. You know, and obviously, as you know, and it's obvious, there are cases in which incarceration is the only means of disposal, but there are so many others where it isn't. Just very briefly, I mean, on a slightly different angle, I mean, what troubles me hugely about prison in this country is the number of offenders who are in prison who shouldn't be in prison, people with personality disorders and mental disorders. Mm-hmm. You know, I think prison staff are incredibly poorly trained and the quality of prison staff is poor. And I know this is not quite the issue you're raising, but what I would like to say while you and I are speaking, Simon, is that I think that the public don't understand, because it's not their world, that our prisons are mainly human dustbins where people are just thrown in together. The whole business, like the guy that I just spoke about, the guy convicted of dangerous driving, who was a professional who made a mistake for 5 minutes that led to him going to prison, fine. But then he's put in a cell with some you know, mentally disordered offender who's charged with violent offences, who shouldn't be in prison at all. The door's open, they're both chucked into this room, and they're left there for, you know, days, weeks or months. I mean, it's the year 2023, for God's sake, and we're doing that all the time. So, yes, I agree with your point about whether the whole ethos of imprisonment serves any purpose or a purpose, but I also think in real terms, the prison system in this country is a complete disgrace. And that's a fact.
No, I mean, that is a fact. One doesn't really know what these judges expect to happen to people when they are condemning them to go off and live in these appalling conditions with no real hope of rehabilitation, I mean, if it happens, it happens despite the prisons, not because of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And why they think ultimately that's going to make things any better.
I don't think judges think about it, really. I don't think they think.
No.
Because, you know, they're just not part of their remit to think about it. Maybe if they spent more time in prisons and saw the mess that prison system is. We do have a terrible prison system, but there it is. That's what we have.
Yeah. I sincerely hope that within my lifetime that changes. Something fundamentally changes there. And I suppose when I started out in my job, I thought that by the time I got to this age, people would have realized that this is unsustainable and it just doesn't happen, which is
I don't think it will change in our lifetimes because there's no real move for change and there are no resources for change. The buildings are generally getting older and older. You know, there's still lots of prisons where people slop out. There are no toilets in their cells. We have, you know, thousands of prisoners in cells designed for two people, whether it's three people, whether there are four people. In many prisons, there's no selection process. So you can be convicted of shoplifting and put in a cell with someone who's convicted of murder. So you've got two people in a cell. One's going to be released at the end of the month. The other one's going to be released at the end of the century. It's just ridiculous. And what are they going to talk about that's, you know, has scope for rehabilitation? It's just shocking. But anyway, it's a topic for another day because it's just too big a topic.
It is too big a topic. But it has been, I hope, a really interesting discussion for our listeners. I hope we've not been too technical. And at times we've taken the time to go back and explain some of the technical terms when we've used them. But it certainly has been a really interesting conversation and a privilege to talk
to you. Likewise. It's been really enlightening, actually, listening to you. I'm a barrister, you're a solicitor, you know, but we have so much in common. And it's interesting and notable that many of our thoughts and ideas mirror each other, you know. I hope that's helpful to the people who listen to this, that they can see that what emerges from the likes of what you and I do are some very fixed concerns that need addressing.
No, I think that's right. And I think that's really a very fitting conclusion to our discussion and this podcast.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Simon.
You once again, Jeremy. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
And that concludes this two-part episode featuring top criminal defence barrister Jeremy Dean in discussion with expert solicitor Simon Natus. Thanks to Jeremy and Simon for sharing their views, insights and concerns on the prison system, the appeals process, and how we should see the system change in future. Rebel Justice Podcast is produced by The View magazine. You can subscribe to The View at theviewmag.org.uk and follow us on our social media. We are Rebel Justice on X, formerly Twitter, and The View magazine on Instagram, LinkedIn and Facebook.